You don't need to tell me what's the big story in the news right now. It's all over social media. One side is accusing the other of rank dishonesty. The other side is throwing that same accusation straight back. The war of words is escalating, getting more and more heated. No one knows where it's going to end or what it will mean for the wider world. I refer, of course, to the conflict between pop queens Beyoncé and Taylor Swift, or rather between their fans. Beyoncé fans allege that Taylor Swift's new video, Look What You Made Me Do, copies the visual style of Beyoncé's 2016 video, Lemonade. But Swift fans, on the other hand, are adamant that Taylor Swift, she already wore a black crop top back in 2015's Bad Blood, so it was really Beyoncé that copied Taylor Swift. Now, I don't pretend to be able to sort out such complex issues in just one Sunday morning. I just raise it to get you to consider, why do you reckon Beyoncé fans and Taylor Swift fans care so much? Who cares who copied who? This is my take on it. It's that who you support says something about who you are. Their significance reflects your significance. So if you're a Beyoncé fan and you can show that Beyoncé is more significant than Taylor Swift, well, that implies that as a Beyoncé fan, you're more significant than a Taylor Swift fan, and vice versa. You get your significance from who you support. You see it in music all the time. You also see it in sport. After last Sunday's A-League game, MasterChef's George Kalambaras was charged with assault. Now, what makes Melbourne Victory fans and Sydney FC fans get stuck into each other so much that they actually come to blows? Isn't it because, well, if my team's better than yours, that makes me better than you? You get your significance from who you support. You see it in politics. One person is like, well, I support this party because, you see, I'm economically sensible, unlike some people. And the others are like, oh, really? Well, I support this party because I'm environmentally ethical, unlike some people. See it in music, see it in sport, you see it in politics. Do you see it in yourself at all? As we look this morning at Paul's letter to the Christians in Corinth, you even see it in people's support for particular Christian leaders. Have a look there in your Bible at verse 12. Verse 12 there, this is the problem that Paul is addressing. He says, one of you says, I follow Paul. Another, I follow Apollos. Another, I follow Cephas. Still another, I follow Christ. Paul says there's division among the Corinthians and it's over which Christian leader they support. See, one says, well, you've got to know this about me. I follow Paul, the one who originally established this church in Corinth. In fact, you might not know, he personally baptized me himself. So that makes me more significant than you lot. Another says, well, Paul's a very simple speaker, isn't he? I can see why that might appeal to someone like you. But for my much more sophisticated tastes, I prefer the polished style of Apollos. That's the kind of person I am. Noah says, well, that's nice for you guys if you don't happen to have any real connections with properly powerful people like I do. You might like to know I'm personally connected to Peter, the founder of the first church in Jerusalem. Or as I call him, Cephas. He likes me to call him by his Aramaic name. And yet another says, well, you all sound a lot less spiritual than me. Because you see, you're all stuck on these intermediate leaders, whereas I follow Christ directly. That makes me more significant than all of you. Now, Paul knows full well this is perfectly natural, perfectly normal human behaviour. I mean, you see it with music, sport, politics and everything else. And here it's happening with Christian leaders. People want to assert their significance, their own significance, over other people. And one way they do that is by who they choose to support. It's natural. It's normal. That's the problem. Because you see, the gospel, the good news that changes everything, it's meant to change everything, especially the way you find your significance. As Paul says to the Corinthians a little later in his letter, it's up on the screen, he says, since there's jealousy and quarrelling among you, aren't you worldly? That is, aren't you still thinking like the rest of the world who doesn't yet believe the gospel? Aren't you acting like mere humans when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos? People who believe the gospel, people who believe that the one who died for sin is king, you're meant to be changed by that belief. You're not meant to be natural and normal anymore. Not in the way you find your significance, anyway. The Corinthians have believed the gospel, apparently. They're Christians who go to church, and yet they haven't been changed the way they should. Not yet, anyway. Paul's hope is that they will change if only they reflect more deeply on this gospel that they already believe. In the part we read together, Paul basically says there's two ways that the gospel rescues you out of this mess of asserting your own significance over other people the way people usually do. The message that the one who died for sin is king gives you two key benefits that help you out of that mess. It gives you, first of all, a new standard by which to assess the significance of anyone or anything. And second, a new boast to make about your own significance. Let's look at them both with Paul. First, the gospel gives you a new standard by which to assess the significance of anyone or anything. See, the Corinthians are assessing their own significance and that of their leaders. And the standards they're using are the world's. They're like, okay, well, if the world values wisdom, intelligence, education, sophistication, then I want to be associated with Apollos who has those things. Or if the world values power and influence and authority, well, then I want to be associated with Peter who has those things. Paul says, you've got to know something about the world's standards of wisdom and power. You've got to know something about the world's standards of significance. They've been proven completely empty and worthless by the death of Jesus. See, only the death of Jesus can save people. Only Jesus stepping in and taking the death you deserve will see you rescued from death in the end. That's the gospel. The one who died for sin is king. That's what we've talked about the last couple of weeks, and it's good to go back online if you haven't heard those. But if you were to judge the cross of Christ by the world's standards of significance, the world's standards of wisdom and power, how would it fare? Look at verse 22 there. Paul says, Jews demand signs of power and Greeks look for wise-sounding arguments. That's the world's standards of significance. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews because the cross looks so weak by their standards, and foolishness to Gentiles because the cross looks nonsensical by their standards. But we know the truth, says Paul in verse 18. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, everyone who's dying from a life lived apart from God. But to us who are being saved by Jesus from that same perishing we deserve to us it is the power of God. That's the true significance of Jesus' death on the cross. The point is, the wisdom and power of the world don't get you there. They don't help you see that. In fact, verse 21... see that there? The world's wisdom and power don't get you any knowledge of God at all. That's what shows, verse 20, how foolish and weak is the so-called wisdom and power of the world. Paul says, in effect, hey, Corinthians, I see you're assessing your own significance and that of your leaders by the world's standards. But if you cared about the world's standards of significance, you would never have seen that the one who died for sin is king. You'd have just thought Jesus' death was weak and foolish. But then if you've come now to see the truth that when Jesus was dying on the cross, it wasn't weak and foolish, that was God's wisdom and power on full display. If you've come to see that, why do you still care about the world's standards that you know contradict that truth? You see his argument. Now, you might think that goes only for ancient standards of wisdom and power, that we've moved on, we have much better standards today. Let's consider it. When I think of someone today who's wise, educated, intelligent, knows a lot, one of the first people that springs to mind is Stephen Hawking. He's the kind of people a lot of people, I think, would like to be associated with. His book, A Brief History of Time, explores how far science has come toward having a grand theory of everything. And of all the people in the world who would know how far science has come, it would be Hawking himself. And if you've read it, and if, unlike me, you actually understood it, I'm guessing you probably wouldn't mind other people knowing that about you, that you're smart enough to understand Stephen Hawking. Am I wrong? Then listen to how Hawking ends his book. He says, if we do discover a complete theory, then we shall be able to take part in the discussion of the question why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, that would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God. Hawking admits we've got a long way to go just to understand the physical universe, and if we get there, we still won't know the really, really important thing. Why there's a universe. The purpose of God. The mind of God. What's clear is that for all Hawking's massive intelligence and learning, which is real and valuable in other ways, it hasn't got him any closer to seeing God's power and wisdom in the death of Jesus. So if you do see God at work in the cross, why would you still try to find your significance by a standard of intelligence and learning that you know doesn't see God at all? Or if you think about those who are most powerful and influential in Australia today, I imagine most of us wouldn't mind being close to at least one of these guys, depending on your political leaning. And if you were close, I bet you wouldn't mind other people knowing that about you, that you were that significant to be close to one of them. But which of them, with all their power and influence, can save people from perishing the way the cross of Christ can? And if you know they can't, why would you still try to find your significance by a standard of power and influence that you know is too weak to save? Paul says when you really get the gospel, when you see that the one who died for sin is king, you'll actually develop a healthy disrespect for all the standards of significance the world clings to for no good purpose. It'll liberate you from caring about how much you measure up against those standards. It'll push you instead to a new standard of significance. What does God think of me? Verse 25, Paul says, the foolishness of God in the cross is wiser than human wisdom. The weakness of God in the cross is stronger than human strength. If you see that, then surely you see it's what he thinks that matters, not what the world thinks. Which, of course, raises the question, what does God think of me? Does he think I'm bad? Does he think I'm good? Does he think I'm significant at all in this vast universe he's made? To which the gospel answer is a resounding yes to all three. So bad Jesus had to die for you. So loved he was glad to. Truly good because Jesus himself is now your righteousness. That's what Paul says there in verse 30. Have a look. Paul says, it's because of God that you're in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God. That is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. See, sinners like us, we're never going to be righteous like God on our own. That's why Jesus had to die for us. But he also chose to out of love for you. In his death, he took away our sin by making us righteous. In his death, he took away our uncleanness, making us holy. In his death, he paid the price to redeem us from slavery to sin, setting us free. So from now on, that's your boast. That's your claim to significance. Not that you're wise or powerful or significant in the world's eyes. That wouldn't really make you significant even if you were. Your boast is that you are significant in the eyes of God, the one whose opinion actually matters. Not because of anything you've done, simply because of Jesus. That's why Paul says, next verse, 31, key verse. See that there? Let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. Can you see then how boasting in the Lord is radically different to any other kind of boast that we humans tend to make? See, when you boast normally, like, I follow her, I follow him, I achieve this, I achieve that, it's all an attempt to make yourself seem better and more significant than someone else. Boasting in the Lord is different. It does show why you're significant. You do matter to God. Look what he's done for you in Jesus. But it doesn't make you any better or more significant than anyone else. Why? Because it's all about what God has done for you in Jesus. Nothing at all to do with what you've done. God's been so generous to you in Jesus that in fact you cannot possibly achieve anything in your life beyond what you've received from him. As Paul says a bit later in the same letter, it's up on the screen. So then no more boasting about human leaders. All things are yours already. You've been given them by God. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or the present or the future, all are yours already given to you. And you are of Christ and Christ is of God. You've received so much in Jesus, you can't add to it yourself. Which should mean no more boasting as if you have done something that someone else hasn't done. As Paul says a bit later in the letter still, up on the screen, for who makes you different from anyone else? What do you have that you didn't receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you didn't? One of the few bits of A Brief History of Time that I did understand was the nice little story that opens the book. I just want to share it with you. Apparently, a well-known scientist once gave a public lecture on astronomy. He described how the Earth orbits around the Sun and how the Sun in turn orbits around the vast collection of stars called our galaxy. And at the end of the lecture, a little old lady at the back of the room gets up and she says, "Sir, what you've told us is rubbish. The world is a flat plate supported on the back of a tortoise." The scientist gives a superior smile before replying, "And what is the tortoise standing on?" "You're very clever, young man, very clever," says the old lady, "but it's turtles all the way down." Now, that's the opening paragraph of the book, and I must admit I didn't understand much after that. But I still give you the gist. It turns out the world is not supported by turtles all the way down. That's my best summary of a brief history of time. It's something else. Not very informative, I know. But I can tell you this. If Paul's right about the gospel, then our lives are supported by God's grace all the way down. There's no bit in the chain of events that you can point to and say, oh, that's where I did better than someone else, which makes me more significant than them. It's God's grace, his undeserved generosity, all the way down. You're not significant because of who you support. You're significant because of who supports you. And that is something to let people know about. That is your boast. That is your significance. I want to close with just one practical way this gospel view of personal significance can help us. See, I've talked about how our search for significance can lead to divisions among us. That was what was happening in Corinth. That's what we see in so many ways today. But for you, it might surface a bit differently. Instead of divisions with other people, your search for significance may lead to division in yourself. Beyonce was on Oprah recently, not to talk about Taylor Swift, just a general interview. And talking about it afterwards, Oprah makes an interesting comment, I thought. She says, I've done over 37,000 interviews since 1989, and after every single interview, the guest always asks me the same question. No matter how famous or successful or powerful or rich or influential they are, they always ask me the same question afterwards. What do you reckon that question would be? That's it. Did I do okay? From Barack Obama to Beyonce, apparently they all ask, they all wonder, they all doubt, how did I go? You'd think Oprah would be used to it by now after 37,000, but she says she was still shocked when Beyonce asked it. After all her success, all her number ones, all her awards, all her sellout tours, even Taylor Swift copying her videos, even after all that, Beyonce still, like everyone else, isn't sure of herself. Still needs someone else to tell her if she's made the grade. Oprah says when Beyonce asked it, she just said, girl, you're Beyonce. I guess people look to the world to settle their uncertainty about their own significance. If you're not certain about your own significance yourself, you kind of ask the world, okay, well, what do you think? But that leaves you enslaved to the world's standards of significance, and you're only ever as good as your last assessment from the world. Do you ever feel that yourself? Well, Paul says the gospel changes that. It changes everything. It offers something better. Listen to the model Paul sets to the Corinthians from his own life. He says to them, in light of the gospel up on the screen, I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I don't even judge myself. You believe that? Where does he get such freedom from insecurity? Such freedom from internal division and self-doubt? Such blissful self-forgetfulness? He gets it straight from the gospel. From the simple knowledge that the one who died for sin is king. Because see, he now knows what God thinks of him. Because of Jesus. He knows how significant he is to the one who really matters. It doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks. or even what he thinks of himself. Wouldn't you like a bit of that? If you would, how can you get it? Well, I can tell you, you won't get it by trying to move on from the gospel to something more advanced. There's no more advanced trick that you need to learn. You don't get it by moving on from the gospel. You get it by moving deeper into the gospel, or rather letting the gospel move deeper into you. Appreciating more and more how this simple message, the one who died for sin is king, really does change everything. How you evaluate the significance of those around you, and even how you see yourself.